The next case is 06722, the Cincinnati Insurance Company versus CPS Holdings, Inc. Mr. Gardner.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Counsel. May it please the court. My name is Richard Gardner, and I represent Cincinnati Insurance Company. I would like to reserve 2 minutes in rebuttal, Your Honor.
Watch your time on the clock there.
Thank you. This is a case in which the appellees, CPS Holdings, Inc., and a variety of related companies and individuals, which I will collectively refer to as CPS, have joined forces with the claimant against them, the state of Ohio, to seek insurance coverage under an umbrella policy issued by Cincinnati Insurance Company with respect to claims made by the state against CPS, seeking approximately, well, just under $6 million in funds that CPS allegedly lost while administering contracts between the state and various natural gas providers. At all pertinent times to this case, CPS carried two insurance policies with Cincinnati Insurance Company. First was a CGL policy, which has been judicially determined not to provide coverage in this case and is not a direct part of this appeal, but does have some tangential influence. The second policy is the subject policy of this appeal, which is the umbrella policy, which was determined not to provide coverage by the trial court, but then in a 2-to-1 decision was found to provide coverage on the basis of an alleged ambiguity in the policy involving the definitions of underlying insurance and the use of the term occurrence, which is in the definition of underlying insurance. Now, I think it's important at this point in time to point out that more than 40 years ago, in 1966, the forerunners of the Insurance Services Office, which is the organization which puts out much of the standardized policy language for the industry, introduced this definition of occurrence. It is defined as an accident which results during the policy period in either bodily injury or property damage, neither expected nor intended from the standpoint of the insured. Although there have been other definitions which have been introduced by ISO and other organizations, this is a definition which is still valid and is used by many insurers today, including Cincinnati, which used it in its definition of underlying insurance and in other provisions in the Cincinnati umbrella policy. Many courts throughout Ohio, including this court 4 years ago in the unanimous decision of Cincinnati Insurance Company versus Anders, found either this definition or derivatives of this definition to be clear and unambiguous. Now, based upon this relatively unremarkable policy language, the trial court, Judge Coyne in Cuyahoga County, found that Cincinnati's motion for summary judgment should be granted, both as to the CGL policy and as to the umbrella policy, and that there was neither a duty to defend nor to indemnify with respect to the allegations made by the state in the Franklin County litigation. Now, the 8th Appellate District, unfortunately, in our view, reversed. There was not much explanation in the 8th Appellate District's majority decision, but it simply found that it was ambiguous. The language that we rely upon was ambiguous. To my knowledge, and based upon the fact that I haven't seen anything from the other side arguing this, this is apparently the first time that this standard language has been found ambiguous in the state of Ohio. I'm asking this court to reverse the 8th Appellate District, to reinstate the trial court's decision finding that there was not coverage under the Cincinnati umbrella policy. Now, the facts, the policy terms, the damages in this case are all essentially undisputed for purposes of the coverage dispute. We are dealing with the allegations made by the state in the First Amendment complaint and the Franklin County litigation. That is set forth in the supplement. We detail those at pages 3 to 4 of our brief. Essentially, the state, as I indicated, is alleging that you have $6 million approximately that was lost, stolen, or somehow misadministered by CPS. It is undisputed that these damages represent economic losses. That is, these are the types of losses that would not qualify as property damage under the Cincinnati umbrella policy or any of the other policies that were involved in the trial court level.
So is your strongest position that there is no bodily injury and there is no property damage and therefore there's no occurrence and therefore there's no coverage?
I guess I can sit down at this point in time, Justice O'Donnell. That's correct. I believe that that's essentially...
I'll stay up there for a few more minutes.
That's essentially where we're at on
this. Other justices here, so you may want to stay there.
What happened was, and I'll deviate a little bit from where I was going to go with this, but if you look at that 1966 definition, which was put out by the forerunners of ISO, unlike the modern definitions, which divorce the two terms of accident and property damage, and by the way, in this case, Justice O'Donnell, we're dealing only with potential, or the only thing that even comes close to the allegations made by the state is property damage. There isn't any bodily injury. There isn't any personal injury or advertising injury in this case. In fact, advertising injury and personal injury were endorsed out of the Cincinnati umbrella policy, so they wouldn't be an issue even if you could make that kind of an allegation. But with respect to property damage, the definition of occurrence, it actually includes the requirement of property damage for there to be an occurrence. So there's not a divorce between accident and property damage to equal occurrence. There has to be both in order for there to be an occurrence. And this is something that many insurers have kept in their policies, including Cincinnati Insurance Company. Now, the terms of the Cincinnati umbrella policy are undisputed. And again, we have those set forth in our brief at pages 12 to 13. If the members of the court want to turn there, there is about a paragraph, which is the insuring agreement. I think it makes sense to go through that at this point in time and to look at the definitions here, because although you sum that up, Justice O'Donnell, I think that it's very clear once we read this. It reads as follows: we will pay on behalf of the insured the ultimate net loss which the insured is legally obligated to pay as damages in excess of the underlying insurance or for an occurrence covered by the policy, this policy, which is either excluded or not covered by underlying insurance because of property damage covered by this policy occurring during the policy period and caused by an occurrence. Now, there may be some redundancies there, but I'll tell you that I don't believe there's any ambiguity or any contradictory terms. Now, like many insurance policies, the beginning of the umbrella policy states that if you have terms that are in quotes, you need to look at the definition section. That's not unusual. That's something that we learn very early on when we become lawyers, that words are specifically defined. And there are two definitions which I think are important for this court's consideration. The first is the definition of occurrence, which we've already addressed, essentially an accident that results in property damage for our purposes here today. The second is the definition of underlying insurance. And it is defined as follows, quote, the policies listed in the schedule of underlying policies. So we have specifically scheduled underlying policies. And the insurance available to the insured under all other insurance policies, and then the important language, applicable to the occurrence, in quotation marks. So again, a specifically defined term. And when we look at this, I would suggest to the court that if we were to look at this policy in the abstract, there would really only be four circumstances under which this policy could provide coverage, only one of which is argued by CPS and the state in this case. Obviously, you could have a circumstance where there's an allegation that there's a specifically scheduled underlying policy that provides coverage, and therefore the Cincinnati umbrella policy has access to that. Well, it's not really applicable here. The only scheduled underlying policy we have in this case is the Cincinnati Commercial General Liability Policy, and as a matter of law, it doesn't provide that coverage. It's already been determined, and that has not been appealed.
But the Gulf policy is the other policy here, but that also isn't in the schedule, is it?
It is not. That is correct, Justice O'Donnell. It is not a scheduled underlying policy. Therefore, what CPS and the state tried to do and what the 8th Appellate District said was, we're going to consider this to be unscheduled underlying insurance. And the definition of underlying insurance does include unscheduled policies, but they have to be applicable to the occurrence. And there are two other circumstances we won't go into. It's sort of drop-down coverage. There's no argument that's made that there's any kind of drop-down coverage provided here. So I won't go into those. Let's take a look, though, at what the CPS and the state argue. They essentially go to that Gulf policy, Justice O'Donnell, and they say, this qualifies as unscheduled underlying insurance, and therefore the Cincinnati umbrella policy has to provide coverage in excess of this errors and omissions policy. And they argue that somehow, I'm not exactly sure how, that the rule of contra profferentum should be used to trigger this excess coverage. And of course, when I use that term, I'm talking about the rule that an ambiguity should be construed liberally in favor of the insured and strictly against the insurer. However, I believe these arguments are wrong as a matter of law, and there's a very simple analysis that should have been employed in this case as a matter of law that would have resulted in the correct outcome. The key is whether or not the Gulf errors and omissions policy qualifies as underlying insurance. And remember, when we go back to that definition, there are two subparts. First being whether or not it's specifically scheduled, which it is not. Second being whether or not it is insurance available to the insured under all other insurance policies applicable to the occurrence, in quotation marks. Now, we're dealing only with this second subpart, and the definition of occurrence requires an accident that results in property damage. This court has already found that that's clear and unambiguous. Every other court, with the exception of the 8th Appellate District, which has addressed this, has found that that's clear and unambiguous language. So it seems that the answer should have been that there is no coverage here because that Gulf errors and omissions policy does not qualify as underlying insurance. Now, that should have been the result. Now, there are a number of arguments which have been raised by the state CPS to counter this. There's only one that I'll address at this point in time, and I will save the rest for rebuttal if necessary. And that is essentially both CPS and the state argue for different reasons that the Cincinnati umbrella policy is ambiguous. If you read CPS's argument, they say, well, look, ignore the definition of occurrence. And basically, the way you should read that definition is rather than the way it's specifically defined, the way it has been set forth in the insurance industry for over 40 years, you should read it to refer generically to the allegations of the Franklin County litigation. Now, it's not surprising that there's no precedent cited by CPS for this argument. This seems to be contrary to Ohio law, contrary to the plain language of the umbrella policy. The state takes a little bit different argument. They say, well, look, at the occurrence definition should be ignored because it presupposes a limitation on the type of underlying insurance that excess coverage could be provided for. I read that and I said, well, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it's supposed to do, is to specifically limit the types of policies that would be underlying insurance for the Cincinnati umbrella policy. I mean, the party specifically contemplated this and put that in the policy, well, at least Cincinnati did, and put it in there for that reason. What the state wants to do is to have you label the Gulf errors and omissions policy as underlying insurance, and then work backwards to undermine that definition by saying, well, look, the Gulf errors and omissions policy doesn't fall within that definition squarely, so you should find that that definition is ambiguous. That's kind of putting the cart before the horse, and we would ask the court to take a look at the definition and say, the issue is whether or not it qualifies under that definition. If it does not, it is not underlying insurance, and therefore there was no duty to defend or indemnify on the part of the Cincinnati umbrella policy. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Mr. Rutter.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Bob Rutter, representing CPSIQ in this case. Let's start with the issue that we're really here on is a duty to defend issue. It is not a duty to indemnify issue. The Court of Appeals and the trial court dealt only with, and that was the only subject that was briefed, is there a duty to defend in this case? And the Court of Appeals first held, yes, there is a duty to defend with respect to Gulf Insurance, and then held correctly, in our view, that Gulf Insurance could qualify as an underlying policy. And since Cincinnati had issued an umbrella policy that is, in theory and practice, supposed to be broader than the coverage provided by the underlying insurance, that it would make sense for Cincinnati to have that same obligation. Now, there is no evidence before the court that this is a standard policy, that this policy is used all across the nation. In fact, I don't see any cases cited to the court in which this particular clause has even been interpreted by any other court, which to me suggests that this is a rather unique and narrow clause used by Cincinnati, perhaps only.
The underlying case that the claim was filed on is basically a breach of contract, is it not? I mean, they claim either a breach of contract or fraud. They either stole the money or they misappropriated it. They didn't pay the bills like they were supposed to, and the money disappeared. That's the underlying case, is it not?
There are more allegations than that. There are certainly allegations of negligence and professional negligence.
But we have held repeatedly that breach of contracts cannot be the basis of tort claims. So where are you basing your entire claim of coverage on the fact that you've put in allegations of negligence and professional negligence?
Well, these are not my allegations, Justice.
Your clients,
these,
I understand.
These are allegations of the Department of Administrative Services.
Okay.
And they have alleged, among other fraud and breach of contract and other things, they've also alleged professional negligence in the way that my client intermingled funds in joint checking accounts that should not have been done, and whether you classify
no
that as
what,
negligence or professional negligence, that's an allegation in the
okay.
complaint.
But no matter how you cut it, we have repeatedly in this court said that you can claim negligence all you want, but a breach of contract is a breach of contract and does not allow tort damages unless there is a physical injury or property injury. Have we not said that?
You have said that.
So your basis on duty to defend rises out of the language in the complaint of a complaint of negligence and professional negligence, correct?
That's correct.
It does not arise out of the breach of contract, and it does not arise out of the allegations of fraud, correct?
There is no coverage for fraud or breach of contract. We agree with that.
So if our court has clearly said that we don't allow tort damages for breach of contract actions, no matter how you label them, then why is the court not able to say there's no coverage, there's no duty to defend? Otherwise, you're bound by any creative plaintiff putting language in to get a duty to defend when they know there is never going to be a duty to indemnify.
I seem to recall we had this same conversation in 2002 when we were here for the Colelli case, which was also a Cincinnati case. And we were talking about how does the duty to defend work? Do you need to establish the true facts? And is the duty to defend based on the true facts as eventually proven? Or does the duty to defend depend only on the facts in the complaint? And my position then and my position now is, in order to work, the duty to defend has to rely only on the facts alleged, because the facts as proven are going to come much later, or they may never come at all if the case is settled.
But the facts as alleged have to have some basis in truth, or any creative attorney can put facts in and always get a duty to defend out of any company.
Well,
and where do you
know,
draw that line?
We don't know all of the facts that the Department of Administrative Services will use to establish that my client committed professional negligence. We have general pleading rules, obviously, that just say all you have to plead is negligence. You don't have to plead all of the underlying facts.
What is professional negligence?
I would say negligence committed by somebody who has a professional obligation. And in this case, it was an obligation to professionally procure and manage the natural gas accounts on behalf of the state of Ohio.
And if they don't, it's a breach of contract?
Well, I don't believe, Your Honor, that a breach of contract and negligence are necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, I would envision many situations where you could act negligently and breach a contract at the same time. I mean, we have professional negligence cases with attorneys. I mean, if I miss a statute of limitations, the fact that I have a contract with my client to represent my client, does that mean my client has to sue me on a breach of contract theory, or are they allowed to sue me on a tort theory? And my experience has always been clients can sue on tort theories. And I think we can find lots of examples of that in the field, at least in the field of professional negligence. So if we recall back to the Colelli case, at that time we were arguing about true facts versus alleged facts, and this court made the decision in Colelli to limit the preferred risk case, which was the true facts case, to limit that case to its own facts, which to me suggested the court agreed. You have to deal with the facts as alleged. Now, if it proves to be, as we progress through with discovery, that there are no facts that would justify this professional negligence claim, then the proper procedure would be for CPS to file a summary judgment saying this negligence claim is incorrect, it has to be removed. Once it's out of the case, then presumably there would not be a duty to defend.
I want to take you back to the issue that Justice Stratton was discussing with you. And Judge Cooney, in her dissent, as you know, analyzes the complaint and the underlying contract. And she makes the comment that in order to maintain a negligence action, DAS must prove that CPS owed them a duty. The only duty that arises under this cause of action is a contractual one. Why isn't that the way in which we should look at this issue?
Well, I would get back to my comment. That's an allegation that to me seems to go beyond the allegations of the complaint. I mean, at this point, I'm not sure how we know why DAS has included this action and what they're basing it on.
Well, but the complaint says, according to her, complaint says professional negligence claim that CPS owed plaintiff a duty to provide reasonable care to act in a competent manner in the course of providing cash management and so forth arises from the contract. There isn't any question about that. Didn't the contract provide a certain level of a duty that was owed?
I'm not sure I can tell you the exact terms of the contract, Your Honor, and whether it specified every duty that CPS was to perform. But I would think that, again, as drawing back to the analogy of a contract with whether it's your accountant or your attorney, the fact that you have an accountant or you have a contract with that person doesn't necessarily mean the duties are limited and defined by the contract. There could be duties imposed by law, as there are on many professionals in the state of Ohio, that would not be encompassed in a particular contract. And if we use the true facts and we try to develop and look behind the words of the complaint, I believe what will happen is we'll have many situations where there'll be constant arguing about whether the defense should be provided while the case is ongoing, and you're going to have perhaps parallel proceedings in which you're arguing about the true facts over here in the coverage case while other true facts are being developed in the underlying case. And quite frankly, the duty to defend is something that has to be established and accepted immediately. It can't be developed later on.
If we go your route, what is to keep attorneys from alleging in every breach of contract case also a professional duty that was violated and therefore automatically gets a duty to defend?
Well, the rules of ethical conduct, for one. I mean, you have to allege.
No, but if we establish a rule of law accepting your proposition, then they're given full legal authority to do so.
I can't speak to that circumstance. I mean, could it happen? I don't know. I would like to think that attorneys don't file causes of action that they know have no legal basis. I mean, presumably, when they're filing the cause of action, they have a basis for it. We're supposed to have a good faith basis under the ethical rules, and I would hope that that's the way attorneys act.
And under your analysis, if the Gulf policy is in, then Cincinnati has a duty to defend the entire case, or do they just have a duty to defend the errors and omissions?
They would have a duty to defend the action once Gulf no longer has a duty to defend for whatever reason. I mean, in point of fact, that's what's happening now. We are being defended by Gulf. The matter is proceeding. It's set for trial in August. The discovery deadline's in a couple of weeks. You know, as a practical matter, this duty to defend from Cincinnati isn't really very significant anymore. I mean, it's not going to really help us in the underlying case. I think what we're really here arguing about is the duty to indemnify. Although that's not what the Court of Appeals ruled on, that's really what Cincinnati wants to do. They want to get off the hook for indemnity. I mean, the duty to defend, quite frankly, is, you know, they're never going to be called on to defend.
What would extinguish the duty that Gulf has to defend, though, building on Judge Pfeiffer's question? When would Cincinnati be obligated to defend this matter?
In my view, they would be obligated to defend if and when Gulf exhausts its duty to defend, which would be
a dollar amount?
$1 million coverage, and it's got $1 million in defense coverage.
$1 million in defense coverage. So when they spend $1 million in attorney fees and discovery, then Cincinnati has to step in.
That would be my view, yes. I mean, the other thing that could happen, I suppose, in a settlement-type position is if Gulf offered their $1 million and said, here's our $1 million, we want off the hook. At that point, if that ever happened, then we would turn to Cincinnati. I mean, it hasn't happened yet. I don't know whether it ever will happen, but that would be the other scenario that I could visualize that occurring in.
Mr. Rutter.
As I said, the case is going forward with or without Cincinnati, and that's where things stand right now.
Since you raised the issue of indemnity, could you address the issue of the damages that are being requested? As I understand, these are economic damages only. Is that correct?
They are money damages. That's correct.
So looking at the policy from the standpoint of the definition of occurrence, would you comment on that, please?
Well, we have abandoned our argument that we raised earlier that money damages could constitute property damage. All right, number one, we just didn't think there was enough case law out there to support that. Our position is not that these damages qualify as property damage. Our position is that when you read the provision that Mr. Garner just talked to you about before, that provision is so inartfully drawn that the property damage requirement is not part of the requirement when you are going against underlying insurance. And then we get into the definition of occurrence and the argument we raised in our brief that talking about an occurrence, I think, is different than talking about the occurrence. The occurrence, to me, refers to the underlying claim that's giving rise to this issue. And in this case, that happens to be the claim being made by DAS.
So you're arguing the article causes the ambiguity, the and? That's where we have the ambiguity?
I think it is among the reasons. There is also the fact that the clause itself, as you read it, can be interpreted, I believe, reasonably in more than one way. And there's also the fact that although Cincinnati claims it has no duty and it doesn't indemnify for professional negligence, it has a separate exclusion that excludes a very, very narrow set of professional negligence. And of course, the question that arises is, if you're not covering professional negligence as part of your umbrella, why do you bother to even exclude computer-related negligence services and the few other narrow circumstances?
So, counsel, would you agree then that whether you say an occurrence as being definitive or the occurrence, the definition for occurrence remains constant?
Well, the policy defines occurrence, and it does have a definition in there.
Okay.
I mean, I would agree with that.
And Mr. Rutter, that's the area that I wanted to explore with you. You're not suggesting there's any bodily injury here.
We are not.
You just told us you abandoned your claim with respect to property damage.
That's correct.
And this is all about an economic loss.
That's correct.
How does any of that fall into the definition of an occurrence?
If you read occurrence as one of the requirements for that definition, Your Honor, I would agree that it does not. Our position, though, is that the way this clause is written, that it provides coverage for two situations. When there is coverage in an underlying situation, that's an excess part of it. And number two, when there's no coverage underneath. We're claiming that when you read the insuring agreement, that we can read that insuring agreement as not requiring or not imposing the occurrence argument.
But it says underlying policy only if it is applicable to the occurrence. So doesn't that take you back to occurrence?
I don't doubt, Your Honor, that that is one reasonable way to read the policy. What we differ on is whether that's the only reasonable way to read the policy. And I would say that when you're talking about the occurrence, it is reasonable, as the Court of Appeals found, to refer back to the underlying event that's giving rise to the charges.
But the term occurrence still has quote marks around it, indicating that it's a defined term, doesn't it?
It does.
So, Mr. Rutter, the only way for us to find in your favor is to find ambiguity in the policy. Would you agree with that?
I would say yes, with a caveat. And the caveat being, the court's obligation is to determine whether there's more than one reasonable way to read the policy. If there's only one reasonable way to read it and it favors Cincinnati, then obviously Cincinnati prevails. If there is more than one reasonable way to read the policy, it is not the court's job to determine which is the more reasonable and go with that. What the court's obligation is under the doctrine of contra preferentum is to say, if there is any reasonable way to read the policy that favors the insured, That's what we have to go with. And in this situation, we feel there is more than one reasonable way. We would agree with you, Justice O'Donnell. You could read it the way you're suggesting. We just think there is another reasonable way, and that reasonable way favors the policyholder, and that's the way the court should then rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rutter. Mr. Gardner, you've saved almost 3 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to start off with Justice O'Connor. It's my understanding, although I don't have the policy in front of me, that the Gulf Errors and Omissions policy has self-eroding limits. So you do have, I think the $1 million goes to defense costs and to the indemnity, but without the policy, I can't look at it exactly. There's a couple of things, and I think that everyone understands that the definition of underlying insurance, you've either got scheduled underlying insurance or you've got other policies which are applicable to the occurrence. And I think just about everybody on the court indicated understanding of our argument being that applicable to the occurrence, you have to look at that definition. I do want to address one of the things Mr. Rutter brought up about the fact that he believed that this was something close to a manuscripted policy or a policy that doesn't have widespread application. The definition of underlying insurance may not be out there in this form, but the definition of occurrence all over. We've cited cases in our brief, our reply brief at pages 16 to 17 dealing with the definition of occurrence. This court decided the issue in Cincinnati Insurance Company versus Anders, looked at this exact same language. Which brings us to the Anders case, which is another interesting case because one of the other underlying arguments that were made by the state and CPS in this case was this continually going back to this idea of, well, we've pled negligence, we've pled negligence, we've pled negligence, so therefore we get coverage. Wrong. You have to plead what essentially would be an accident that results in property damage during the policy period. Now, negligence many times will have that if you're talking about negligence that results in property damage or negligence that results in bodily injury. But negligence in and of itself doesn't get you there. That's exactly what this court said in Anders. And if you go back and you look at your decision, which was unanimous in Anders, that was a negligent misrepresentation case. And you had actual property damage in that case to the home, but there was an allegation that it wasn't disclosed when it should have been disclosed. This court found, well, they may have pled negligence, but that didn't result in property damage, this negligent misrepresentation. And we're not going to, these types of policies don't provide coverage for negligence claims that don't result in property damage or bodily injury. In that sense, these policies really aren't negligence policies. They're policies that provide coverage for an accident that results in property damage or bodily injury. So we want to make sure that we're clear on that. I don't think we need to talk a whole lot more about property damage since it's apparent now that that he's conceded that there is no property damage in here. The professional services exclusion is mentioned. Go back and read it. This is an exclusion that limits when you can get coverage for property damage or bodily injury. It doesn't supplant the requirement of showing that there's property damage. It limits the times when you can get property damage. If you have professional malpractice that results in property damage, it would be excluded under this policy. I believe my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.